IPU On Air, the Interparliamentary Union's podcast.
Welcome to IPU On Air, the Interparliamentary Union podcast on all things parliaments, parliamentarians, and legislative issues. I'm Kate Brooks from the IPU, and I'm happy to be hosting this episode today of Holding the Gavel Behind the Role of the Speaker, live from IPU HQ, the House of Parliaments here in Geneva, where we're actually meeting on the eve of our 151st Assembly. Today I have a special guest who's joining us all the way from Australia and who approaches the role of Speaker with objectivity and a uniquely Australian energy, the Honourable Milton Dick from the Australian House of Representatives. Mr. Dick has dedicated his career to public service, from local government in Brisbane, Queensland, to running as an MP successfully in 2016 and Speaker of the House since 2022. He's known for his commitment to parliamentary cultural reform, civic education, and making Parliament more accessible, particularly towards young people in Australia. Mr. Speaker, welcome to IPU On Air.
I'm looking forward to this, Kate.
So you first became Speaker in 2022, after 6 years as an MP in Parliament. What were your first thoughts on taking up the gavel?
I was pretty petrified about, would I have the authority? Would members of Parliament listen? Although I had only been a member of Parliament for a short time, I came from a approach of thinking that if I worked hard enough at the rules and understood all the rules and learnt the rules and memorised the rules, I'd be a good speaker. But what I learned very quickly is it's not necessarily about the rules. Absolutely, you need to understand the rules and know the standing orders. But it is also the relationships and how you present those rules as well. So theoretical and practical, if that makes sense.
Was there anything that surprised you when you took up the role?
Yes. Surprising for me in Australia, where I probably wasn't aware that so many people in Australia watched Parliament. When I was an MP, I would obviously be known in my district or my electorate. I wasn't prepared for people at across different parts of Australia or the shopping centres or the airport stopping me and actually knowing what had happened. So it was probably more of a surprise to me just how many people I then learned very quickly were watching what I did as well, which wasn't a criticism. I just wasn't prepared for that, for when you're just getting a coffee and people saying, why did you make that decision? Or can I ask you about this decision? And that's probably a uniquely Australian thing as well, where people feel they can just come up to you all the time, which I actually love.
Yeah. And I think in Australia, having watched a lot of Question Times myself, you know, sometimes, particularly when things get a bit lively, the speaker can take on an amusing or celebratory role in how they manage the dynamics of Parliament. Have you got any interesting stories about that?
Look, no. I mean, I don't buy this argument that politicians are celebrities. I know there's a bit of a perception, and you may look at parts of the world and, you know, the reach of social media. Some politicians have millions of followers, obviously, presidents. And I'm more about making sure the institution is respected and protected. I often say, as speakers, and I talk to my colleagues here at the Assembly and as a member of the Executive Committee, those speakers who are on there, we have to protect democracy inside the chamber, but also outside the chamber as well. So, yeah, I mean, that's how I sort of look at it. And hopefully in Australian context, if I'm not in the news or making news, that's a good thing, because speakers aren't making the laws, we're overseeing the laws.
Great. That's a great segue to my next question, which is about your key duties as a speaker. Sometimes people think of the speaker's role as just a presiding officer, but it goes much further beyond that. And you can also serve as a bridge between the parliament and the public. Can you speak a little bit to that part of the role?
Yeah, I mean, to my point around being a protector and guardian of democracy when democracy around the world is under pressure, I take a very practical point of view that the more we empower citizens in Australia, our region, which is the Pacific, and Asia Pacific, and then the world, the stronger our democracy will be. So I take a very practical approach to guarding democracy. And that is as simple as I visit schools and I go and teach about democracy in classrooms, which I absolutely love. And I bring the members of parliament for that area or district with me. And we talk about not politics or parties, but we talk about democracy. We talk about why we have democracy, how democracy was formed, and teach people about things like the Interparliamentary Union, which parliamentary diplomacy is different from governmental diplomacy. So I take a practical view of right down to the classrooms. And in Australia, I think I've gone about 207 school visits across Australia in our regional and remote areas, sitting down with young people in particular to empower them, because they will be maybe one day a speaker or representatives themselves.
And at the IPU, one of our big streams of work is getting young people more involved in politics and getting them more engaged with their political system. What are some of the questions that the youth ask you when you're out there engaging in this work?
They want to know how it all works, and then you get to the why you do the job. So I do a lot of explanations about how Parliament works, how laws are made, and then we get into the why. And I always tell young people who are interested in democracy or perhaps becoming a parliamentarian, know your why you want to be there, why you want to serve, or why you want to help people, or whatever the problem you want to solve or perhaps influence the outcome. So that's where we start. And I primarily go to year in Australia, year 5 and 6, which is 10 and 11 year olds, and I do older. In Australia, recent surveys have shown that young people don't have a full knowledge on civics. And I'm on a real mission in the Pacific, particular with our family members there in the region, to empower young people. It's not good enough just to say, you should run for parliament or nominate or join a party. You need to explain to young people the principles of democracy and how they then can participate. And not everyone I speak to or not everyone wants to be a member of parliament, but there are certainly avenues that people can participate in democracy. So for me, it's about the participation, or as I always say in Australia, turning up. The more people that turn up, the stronger our democracy, the stronger the world will be.
Yeah. And Australia is a bit unique in that way, in the sense that we have compulsory voting in Australia. Are young people often asking questions about that, or do you find that they're very eager to participate in the system?
Yeah, most young people are, I would say, have a thirst for participation. We have always had a very long tradition of compulsory voting or compulsory turning up. Australia has a very unique electoral system where it's compulsory voting and it's compulsory preferential voting as well. And Australia, which I always love boasting about, particularly to your listeners and to anyone who'll listen, was the first place in the world that granted the women the right to vote. And also one of the first places in the world where women could stand for office as well. So we've had a long commitment to democracy, and next year Australia celebrates its 80th year of involvement with the IPU. So we're documenting our involvement with the IPU and doing a history on our engagement. And when we became a federation and Australia began, we set a small donation to the IPU in 1901 to participate and to make sure that even all those years away, so far away, we believed in the world coming together.
Our listeners may not know, but the IPU has been around since 1889. So it's not too long after that that Australia came on the scene in that context. You mentioned earlier work on parliamentary diplomacy and how it's very different from governmental diplomacy. And it's obviously a big part of why you're here this week and why MPs engage with the IPU. What do you find about these events adds value to your work as a speaker, and particularly this assembly, which is focusing on international humanitarian law? What role do you have to play there?
Well, I always learn something. Politicians and from our different geopolitical regions, we think we know a lot, But it's when you're in a room and you hear someone's story, you hear what their country has been through or what their parliament has done or their constituents have had to live through. Hearing the lived experience and the world is under environmental pressures. We've got migration movements. We've got food insecurity. You know, the world has some complex problems. And bringing people together, and that's the charter of the IPU, of consensus, sitting down, sharing, and then coming up with solutions, is really, really important. And when I first came to the IPU, I wasn't really sure what to expect. And I'm just brought in some new delegates coming for the first time from Australia. And I explained to them that the best thing you're going to get out of an assembly is, of course, the decisions and the reports and all the formal kind of part of the workings and the work of the Secretary General and the President and the amazing work the committees do. But it's also the people connection you'll make, getting lunch with someone, talking to them at an event, and hearing their story that you would simply never have the opportunity. And I've had the privilege now, working through the IPU, through the Executive Committee and through Chair of Finance Committee, making connections and then visiting parts of the world that I never would have done before. And this assembly, I've been able to visit parts of Eastern Europe. And a couple of weeks ago, I had the privilege of visiting Southern Africa and Central and Southern Africa as well, through colleagues that I've met here. And that expands my knowledge as a speaker, but also as a global citizen.
Yeah. And have you had the opportunity to take something that you've learned or a good practice back to Canberra and learn from it?
Yes. Coming back to the youth principles, one of the early conversations I had with a number of colleagues and speakers were talking about how to get young people involved. And a couple of speakers taught me about their youth parliaments and their youth engagement. So 3 months ago, Australia launched its first National Youth Parliament. And that was as a result of one of the conversations and one of the meetings that we had here with the IPU's campaign about empowering young people. And we've taken that to action. So in 2026, so next year, we've never done that before. And we're going to have 16 and 17-year-olds from every corner of our country coming to the parliament, coming to Canberra to take over. And to give people, young people, a direct voice into their future. And the IPU supported that. And that's one of your objectives, the objectives that the Secretary General and the President continually speak about. So, yeah, that's something I'm really looking forward to as well. Probably a bit scared as well. I don't know what the young people are going to do when they take over Parliament, but we're really looking forward to that.
Okay, great. That's a fantastic thing to hear that's happening. I want to speak a little bit about parliamentary culture, and you've been a very big advocate for respectful interactions between MPs and also a safe and inclusive work culture within Parliament for staff. Can you speak to a little bit about some of the changes Australia's experienced in your time as Speaker in this area?
Yeah, the whole Parliament has been united behind this, and I've had the privilege of leading a response into a major inquiry into workforce and behaviour in our parliament. Around 5 or 6 years ago, there were some serious incidents and some allegations occurred and some incidents occurred. So we had our Sex Discrimination Commissioner come in Australia to do a full review. A Safe at Work, Respect at Work report was initiated. And we've now methodically gone through those recommendations. Changing culture and behaviour is really, really important for me as the Speaker. But I need everyone to do it with me, to walk that journey by my side. So we put practical measures in place, new codes of behaviour, new codes of conduct, even some of the language we use within the parliament, and reviewing our standing orders and procedures about how we can be more inclusive. So getting those tools, what I call, in place, but also ensuring that for new members, they have the skills that they need as well. Our parliament in Australia is the most diverse it's ever been. And we are almost at 50% representation. Certainly half of the government is now represented by women. And one of our chambers it's now 57% of women. So more women than men in our upper house. We have our second female presiding officer, and half the ministry, half the cabinet are women. So we take our commitments to gender equality very seriously. But as a speaker, I have to also make sure the parliamentarians are one side, but around 5,000 people may work in our parliament when parliament is sitting. And every single person needs to be respected and have to be safe at work. So we're just going through those recommendations. But it does start from the top. And we aren't the best in the world by any stage. But we want to strive to be the best in the world in terms of a safe and respectful workplace. The harassment campaign, which the IPU is No Harassment Campaign, which is underway, is something that we want to work closely with, and empower other parliaments to do the same as well. Because the more our parliaments look like our nations, the more we respect each other in our parliaments, I think the stronger our democracy will be.
And so for our listeners, the IPU has recently implemented an anti-harassment campaign that we are pursuing at our events and assemblies, which we're also very proud of. You mentioned working across the aisle and having support on both sides in this most recent example of finding consensus on safe workplaces. Australia is sometimes known for its dynamic interactions within Parliament. Can you speak a bit to your role as a mediator and making sure that both sides can participate and have their say, and also keeping things calm and respectful in the chamber?
Well, that's the holy grail for speakers to look up and to have that moment where everyone is respectful and, you know, debate is running smoothly. I'll let you into a secret that doesn't always happen in our parliament, and I'm still looking for the perfect place for that to occur. We try in our parliament, and I certainly as a speaker, I try and lead by example. And my late parents raised my brother and sister and I with one value. How you treat people is how you expect to be treated. They didn't probably understand why they used to go on about that as a child. And now I'm so thankful that they taught us those values in our family. And that's how I take the role as speaker. In a practical way, I ensure that language and how we speak to and about each other is really important. You could say in a debate, you are the most stupid person who's ever come into this chamber. Or you could say that is the most stupid idea that has ever come into this chamber. There's two different things there. And so I'm really working on encouraging. Ultimately, people are elected and they're held accountable to their constituents in democracy. But I have to uphold our standing orders, the rules and laws of our parliament, but I also try and lead respectfully, because I think the more we can show respect to one another in the world, and I don't know, sometimes as a leader or as a speaker, you know, I hear people say, you have to be firm and hardline and tough. I take a slightly different approach. I think the more you can listen to each other and perhaps a little more kindness to one another, the stronger the debate can be. And I think strong leaders can also be compassionate leaders as well.
Is there a lot of behind-the-scenes diplomacy domestically that happens in your role?
Always. I think there's always opportunities for speakers to have conversations that perhaps different politicians don't want to have. So I try and use my office to bring parliamentarians together, and we've got different parties and all sorts of different views and values in our parliament, just like every other place in the world. But I try and use the office of speaker to try and, I call it no man's land, where people can come, share ideas, perhaps over a cup of tea or coffee, without the hostilities. I don't always get it right, but I'm trying to develop those skills where people can come together without necessarily the hostile nature of the parliamentary floor. That's still important, and robust democracies must have good governments, but they must have good oppositions, because oppositions hold governments to account. But we can also negotiate and talk about things we agree on, and it doesn't always have to be in a contest.
You've been in the role for 3 years now. What's been the biggest challenge for you?
I think ensuring as a speaker, and I, not all speakers have done this in Australia, but I have resigned from my parliamentary party. So I don't vote in the parliament. I don't give speeches in the parliament. So making sure that I treat everyone fairly and respectfully and being impartial can be difficult as a speaker because you're still a politician. I've still got to be elected. So I think that's the challenge for me, ensuring that I am delivering the laws and the rules as they are, you know, written down, but also ensuring that my impartiality remains. And I think I'm still working on that. But I was very honoured when we had our recent election a couple of months ago for the Speaker, that I was unanimously endorsed by the Parliament. And that's a huge privilege for me. And I don't say that to boast, but I say that to demonstrate that you have to earn respect. You can't demand respect.
And this challenge of impartiality and fairness is something that all the speakers we've had on this series have mentioned too. What you said about maintaining your independence and stepping away from the party, not being obligatory, was that your own initiative? Is it just something you felt strongly about?
Yeah, out of the deep respect I have for the office of speaker in our constitution, the role of speaker is mentioned, but the prime minister is not. So our founding fathers thought it was a very important part of our democracy. So to honour that legacy and to honour the role, I thought it was appropriate to step aside from all party activities, because it's not fair if the umpire on the team, on the football team, was wearing the team's jersey or even the socks or the scarf. It wouldn't be a fair game of football. And that's how I kind of see. And when I explain to children or young people across Australia, when I visit schools or into our region, I always say that I'm the referee and umpire. I always say, what's the first thing that happens when the ref blows the whistle? And the school students go, you stop and you listen. And I said, and what can happen if you do something wrong? Oh, you get a red card, you could be sent off. I said, well, that's kind of the role of speaker.
Yeah.
And they get it straight away. So I think, yeah, ensuring that impartiality is important. And for me, that was as we say in Australia, a no-brainer. I just had to make that decision, and I'm glad I did.
Part of the speaker's role that not everybody's aware of is sort of managing the legislative agenda, which is a huge responsibility. How do you ensure, and you obviously have a team, staff that help you, but how do you ensure that the calendar runs effectively and that everyone in Parliament is heard, given a fair say, and also that the government have an opportunity to legislate effectively?
Yeah, I mean, we have a number of mechanisms in our parliamentary system. We have a selection committee and private members business where members not from the government can raise issues, introduce bills separate from the government's legislative agenda. And I think that is really, really important. We also have a secondary chamber that not a lot of people know about. So about 30 years ago, the parliament decided to have its main chamber, which is the House of Representatives, obviously, and then a secondary chamber called the Federation Chamber, which is a smaller chamber where non-controversial bills and laws and decisions can be discussed. And that's also a powerful way for oppositions to raise issues, give speeches, and enable the debate to occur in perhaps a less hostile environment. So running the Federation Chamber is the responsibility of our Deputy Speaker, and running the Chamber is obviously my responsibility. But ensuring that everything goes smoothly, not every day is smooth, because people have the right to move suspensions in the Parliament. They may want to bring an urgency motion to the floor of the House, and you manage those as they come through. But I always ensure that it's done in an ordered way and hopefully in a collaborative way, because there are issues, and more issues are coming urgently forward. So we do need to have that flexibility. But I like to set out the agenda for the week so everyone knows what is coming. They can prepare for that, but also have some flexibility if we need it.
And something that we've spoken a lot about with MPs in the last 5 years since the pandemic is the role of reform aimed at improving accessibility and modernising processes, particularly around issues of digitalisation. Have there been any innovations in the Australian Parliament since then that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, we're moving towards a more online presence for our committee hearings. Australia is a very, very big country. It's a continent. The only country that is a continent. And getting around to regional and remote localities was becoming very costly. And I wanted to ensure that the citizens of Australia still participated in their democracy. And we don't value the work of our committees, I believe, enough. And Australia has a very, very robust committee, House of Representatives and a Senate committee, and also a joint Senate committee process to scrutiny legislation, to inquire into issues. So we've used new technology to beam people in so that their evidence can be taken now. All of those things are important, but it's done two things. It's increased the participation of citizens, but also reduced emissions, because we have a responsibility. Our parliament is powered by green energy in Australia, and sustainability in our parliaments is really, really important for me. We have 40,000 lights in our building, and we've changed all of them. We have 42 lifts, and we've changed the way they've operated and reduced our energy costs by 30%. Single-use plastics, all of those things, water reticulation, and how we compost and waste. We even have beehives in our parliament, that we take those obligations seriously, but making sure that we're using technology as well. We're also at the early stages of using artificial intelligence and reviewing how we can maybe use that in our committee process, but making sure the parliamentarians have full oversight.
Yeah, and this is an issue that's going to be AI and artificial intelligence more and more significant in the future. It's very interesting looking at Australia as a case study because of how the country is spread out and how remote and rural some communities are. It must be a challenge, not just from a committee point of view, but reaching citizens and communicating with citizens. And you're from a state that has quite a big rural regional population. How have you managed to balance that?
Well, I come from a state in the north of Australia where more people live outside the capital city than live inside the capital city. So we in Australia need to keep working and learning from other countries around the world what is best practice. I want to make sure our citizens, for example, our school kids get to come to Canberra, but 100,000 students get to visit Parliament each year. You know, they tour, they come to the chamber, they get to meet members of Parliament, or if I'm free, I always go say hello to the kids visiting, but about a million don't. So what are we doing for those kids? How do we engage with citizens? When we have new citizenship ceremonies, what are we doing to make sure our multicultural communities are fully engaged? And we're one of the most, I think, successful multicultural countries in the world. So looking at new technologies and innovations and new programs to engage with communities, the Schools in Parliament program that I spoke about, the National Youth Parliament, and looking at ways to digitalize and improve our communications processes, and using social media as a platform to engage with citizens as well, but also empowering our members of Parliament and our senators to also come on this journey as well. We have a small country, a country of 27 million people, and I want every single one of those to be fully informed of how their democracy work, but we can only do that if we all work together. And so far, a lot of MPs are taking up that challenge, and we've just had an election, so a lot of new MPs are there, including one of the youngest parliamentarians we've ever had is 21. She turned 21 on election day. So using all of the tools that we have to improve democracy, but also improve the power of the citizens as well.
And you mentioned earlier, and we're talking a lot about democratic backsliding and how our political institutions are under threat, trust in them is declining around the world. Our meeting this week is focusing on international humanitarian law, given what's happening around the world and the number of conflicts that are going on at the moment. What do you hope to get from the Assembly this week?
Well, coming back to my earlier remarks, learning. Learning about some of these conflicts. When you're in your country and you see things on the television or the news or your social media, perhaps you don't get the full picture. And so I think learning about some of the issues and the crises that are unfolding, particularly from the smaller islands, smaller development states, and also some of the smaller nations. So I've made it a mission for this assembly. I think I've got a record number of bilateral meetings with countries that we don't have a lot of engagement with. in our region, we work closely together through the Asia Pacific group. But I really want to, as a member of the IPU, learn about some of these challenges and how we may be able to help them as well. Once again, the IPU bringing people together that normally wouldn't have these conversations. So this assembly in particular, I've made it a mission to go and talk to countries I don't know a lot about, but whether these are these crises. And I think some of the decisions through the debates that we're going to have will be meaningful. And I think it is a worthy topic more than ever. We need to be hearing and listening. So I'm going to spend a lot of time in the assembly actually listening to what is the some of the conflicts, improving my knowledge, my delegation's knowledge. And when we go back to Australia, tell our constituents about it so they learn as well. So it's a bit of a two-step process. Being here is one thing, then using that knowledge when we go back to our country and our country groups to empower citizens about that knowledge as well.
And we mentioned earlier you're an active member of our executive committee at the IPU. What do you get from participating in that forum?
Well, I get a lot out of being a member. We had a country group meeting this morning, and I serve alongside two other very distinguished members of the executive committee, Mr. Alsari from Indonesia and Mrs. Sarangi from India. So Australia, Indonesia and India are the three representatives. And we reported to our country group this morning about the work of the executive committee, particularly the five objectives and the work of the secretariat here and also the work of the president. We're able to be that bridge between our countries and to the executive committee, particularly when Australia, where we sit, we're in the Pacific family, and there are a number of issues that we are championing in our region. I've spent a lot of time in the Pacific. Recently, I was in Nauru. I visited Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, Tuvalu, Kiribati, because those countries are really dealing with the issues of climate. So for our region, it is about climate. So being able to raise those issues at the highest level is really, really important. I take my obligations as a member of the executive committee incredibly serious. It was a very big decision for me to nominate, and then the privilege to be supported by my country group. So my responsibilities are to represent and also advocate. So making sure that particularly some of those nations, which have populations maybe of 20 or 30,000 people, so not big countries. And the IPU is always about being big and also small at the same time. So I guess being on the executive is a privilege that I'm able to work with some of those nations to support them, particularly on the issues that maybe normally wouldn't be heard because of their size. So we work closely together at all times, and I'm looking forward to updating the assembly on some of the work that we're doing.
Great. And we always love to hear about smaller parliaments being empowered and giving a voice. That's fantastic. And you mentioned Australia had an election earlier this year. What are your priorities and goals for the parliament for the next few years?
Well, a couple of things. Moving forward on, as I touched on, about the climate sustainability pieces for our parliament, my goal is for the Australian parliament to be clean and green and one of the leaders in the world. I think we talk about sustainability and climate a lot, and there's a resolution about sustainability coming up to this conference that we're very keen to discuss and support. But we have to, as we say in Australia, practice what we preach. And that starts with our own parliaments and the work that the Secretary General outlined to the Executive Committee about some of those sustainability measures that we see here at the Assembly, printing on demand, ensuring that we are cutting emissions by the hybrid models of online, but also in-person, all of those things. So I think my priorities will be around a couple of things. Ensuring that we have the clean and greenest parliament in the world. Focusing on giving young people a voice when it comes to our youth parliament. And also my passion, which is teaching civics. I would love the 44,000 parliamentarians that serve inside the IPU, if I could, give them the opportunities and abilities to go into every classroom in the world where they go and teach about democracy, not politics. They can teach about their democracy and countries and their parliaments, But also, I think for this term, ensuring that respect and language is really important in our parliament. So they're probably my top three priorities.
You mentioned Clean and Green. You've been a supporter of our Parliaments for the Planet campaign, and the IPU is making a concerted effort to also be clean and green at home and at our events as well. And to wrap up, I just want to ask you, what is the most rewarding part of being the Speaker for you in Australia?
That's hard to answer in one quick answer, but I'll try. I think the privilege of meeting people and in our region and working alongside of them. You know, when I was a primary school student and my member of parliament came to the classroom, gave a speech and whatnot, and he asked everyone who could do this job. And I was probably sitting at the back, you know, I was pretty tall back then, but I was sitting back in the classroom and I didn't put up my hand. It wasn't something I thought I would be good at or could do. So I think the most rewarding thing is about going into classrooms or talking about democracy, and if I do it in a very small way or hopeful way of inspiring people, no matter where you come from, no matter what your background is, it doesn't matter how much money you have or where you're from, it's in here and in here that really makes you a good person and hopefully makes you a good member of parliament. So I always say to kids, and I finish on this note, I'll do other things in my life and I'll do other things up to parliament, but I'll never have a job as good as the job I have now. And I treasure every single day. And at the end of each sitting week, we have the mace in Australia, the symbol of democracy. And a big week, you know, you're tired, you're exhausted, and the sergeant, our sergeant at arms, the mace sits in the speaker's office and I get to make sure it's protected. And the sergeant always says, and all the staff are sort of exhausted, and they say, Speaker, that's 1 week down. But I always say that's one less week I'll ever be the Speaker, because it's such a privilege. So,
and I have to mention that you're still the tallest person in the photos that we take here at the IPU at the back. But before we finish, I want to ask you, what was it that changed for that kid in the classroom that didn't put up his hand to make him run for to be an MP?
I think learning, listening and studying about democracy gave me the confidence to then think, well, maybe I can have my voice heard as well. Having some great mentors, having some great teachers at school. I remember my English teacher, and she still lives in my constituency. And I remember her telling me about when I was in high school about democracy. I probably was only listening a little bit because, you know, I was a teenager. But she taught me about why it's important for your voice to be heard. And she gave me, in some ways, the confidence. And this is a very, I didn't know you were going to ask me that question. So honestly, this wasn't set up, trust me. She came and voted I won't say who she voted for because it's a secret vote in Australia. She came and voted, and I happened to be there at the polling booth when she came. We have early voting in Australia. And I said to her, she shook my hand and congratulated me and said hello. And I had the privilege of saying to her that I'm here because you were able to give me the confidence to do it. And she said, oh, surely not. And I said, yeah. And a lot of other people along the way.
So great, sorry. So shout out to
Miss Harris.
We don't forget those teachers, do we? So I think that's a great note to end on, a brilliant story. Thank you so much, Mr. Speaker, for coming and talking to us today. And thank you very much to our listeners for tuning in to IPU On Air. If you would like any more information about what the organisation does, you can visit ipu.org or you can follow us on social media at IPU Parliament.